Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for joining our call again today. Jasmine Chaitram, who usually moderates these calls, is not with us, and so I am Nancy Anderson. I will be taking over for her for this one call. I'm also in the Division of Laboratory Systems at CDC. I'm the Senior Advisor for Clinical Laboratories. The agenda for today's call is posted, so you can see that we have three speakers. As you might have heard on previous calls, the Division of Laboratory Systems at CDC works to advance laboratory quality and safety, data and biorepository science, workforce competency, and laboratory quality improvement across the U.S. clinical laboratory community. As far as the COVID-19 response calls go, we work closely with clinical and public health laboratories across the country to support emergency preparedness and response. So we have been supporting and managing these calls throughout the course of the pandemic to bring emerging and hot topics to the laboratory community and to solicit questions from you all about the important work that clinical laboratories continue to do to support this response. Because we anticipate a large number of participants on this call, and there may be a number of questions that we can't directly and immediately answer, we will take note of all your questions and adjust our feedback and tailor the content of future calls accordingly. So a few more housekeeping things to go over, and then we will get started with our first call today, with our first speaker today, excuse me. We do have a preparedness portal within our Division of Laboratory Systems website, and so the slides that we share during the presentations will be posted online along with the audio and the transcript by sometime next week. You can find them all at the website address that is listed here, and this again is the CDC DLS preparedness portal. Am I not moving on? There we go. This alerts you to the next time we have one of these calls, which will be 2 weeks from today. We have these calls every other week on Monday afternoons from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. So tune in again in 2 weeks, and we will provide you with some updates at that time. This is another reminder that we show you on every one of these calls. Our training and workforce development branch is interested in hearing from you, learning about the education and training needs that your laboratories might be experiencing. So we invite you to reach out to the email address shown on this slide, labtrainingneeds@cdc.gov, and let us know what it is that would be helpful to your laboratory. As you've heard many times on these calls, if you want to ask a question during the webinar, please use the Q&A button that's at the bottom of the screen, or maybe at the top of your screen, for submitting a question. Do not use the chat function. Let's see here. Please include your email address if you do ask a question so that we can get back to you, whether we answer it during the call today or we can get back to you afterwards. If there are people from the media who are listening to this call, please contact CDC Media Relations with any questions that you might have. And if you are a patient or any individual, please direct any questions to your healthcare provider, especially concerning your health. We would like to let you know, because we have a variety of speakers, The slide decks that you see presented might include material from panelists who are not affiliated with CDC. So the presentation content from those external panelists may not necessarily reflect CDC's position on the topics that they cover. And with that, I would like to introduce our first speaker for today, Dr. Brandy Limbago, who's with the CDC Laboratory and Testing Task Force for the COVID-19 response. And she is going to be talking about the CDC influenza SARS-CoV-2 multiplex assay. So with that, I will turn it over to Brandy. And Brandy does not have any slides, so we will just, we have her cover slide up here.
Thanks, Nancy. Can you hear me okay? All right. And actually, just want to start out by dispelling maybe some false expectations. I am not going to be talking about the influenza SARS-CoV-2 multiplex assay. I'm actually going to be talking about CDC's retirement of the previous assay, the CDC 2019 Novel Coronavirus Real-Time PCR Diagnostic Panel, which you may know as the original CDC assay or the CDC singleplex assay. So we are at a very different position in the response and in our experience with SARS-CoV-2 and our capacity for diagnostic testing for this pathogen now than we were back in February of 2020. And because there are so many additional options now that have received emergency use authorization for SARS-CoV-2 diagnosis, including one additional one from CDC, which is the SARS-CoV-2 flu multiplex assay, we have decided to discontinue the CDC emergency use authorization for the singleplex assay. So the timeline for this is that after December 31st, we will withdraw the request from FDA for this EUA. And we're just letting people know this. For any public health laboratories that might be on this call, we will also discontinue distributing this assay through the IRR in September, at the end of September of this year. So really what that means is if you're a public health laboratory and you have been using the original SARS-CoV-2 singleplex assay, now is the time to consider transitioning to the other surveillance assay that CDC has emergency use authorization for. That is the flu SC2 multiplex assay. If you are a clinical laboratory that is using one of the few commercial options that actually is operating under the CDC's EUA, now is also advanced notice for you to begin finding and selecting and verifying another assay to replace the CDC assay. So again, just to be clear, this doesn't affect all of the EUA SARS-CoV-2 detection methods out there. This is specific only to the one that CDC has, and for those who are specifically operating under CDC's emergency use authorization. I think we've already heard a few questions sort of outside of even the chatter here today about, will this impact everything? And it will not. Will this impact, an assay that I'm using that uses the same primer and probe sequences? And if it is a different platform and the manufacturer of that assay has pursued their own emergency use authorization, it will not affect that as well. It's only for those that are specifically authorized and qualified under the CDC EUA, which is really a much more limited set. So I think really that's what I wanted to say at this point. I will take questions at the end or whenever Nancy tells me we're going to take questions on this topic. But just wanted to let you know that is coming. Again, September 30th is when we'll discontinue distribution through the IRR. I should mention we've actually requested that the manufacturers operating under the CDC EUA discontinue distribution about that time as well. And we plan to withdraw our EUA request from FDA at the end of the calendar year. And I see another question. Maybe I'm not supposed to answer them yet. The right of reference will not be revoked. That will remain. It is only the operation under the CDC EUA.
Thank you, Brandy. Yes, you're seeing there are several questions that have come in. So if you are willing to answer a couple more of them, let's see, you answered the one about right of reference. The next one, there was an initial question that I believe you covered in total in your presentation. So the next one that I see that may need a little more clarification, has CDC made a wide announcement about the retirement of the COVID-only assay? I've seen some false information spreading about why it's been retired. I do know that the Division of Lab Systems sent out a LOX message last week about this, so you may want to add anything more to that.
Yeah, thank you. So we have communicated this intention. It went out to the clinical community by the LOX message. It went out to the public health laboratory community through APHL, and it went out to the recipients of IRR reagents through the IRR communication network. So we have been communicating about this. I did, again, you know, sort of through the grapevine here, that there was some whispering that maybe this was due to performance issues or some problem with the assay. That is not true. You know, it is all over the media. I think everyone knows that the very original assay that was rolled out from CDC that had three COVID targets did have problems, and many of the initial laboratories, the public health laboratories who received it, had trouble verifying that assay. It was reconfigured. We went back to FDA and qualified the current singleplex assay, which just has the two SARS-CoV-2 specific targets in it. It has performed well throughout its lifetime, and we are only retiring it because we think it's really not necessary, and it doesn't meet our primary public health surveillance needs any longer. And we think for the surveillance intention, which is again what the public health laboratories will be doing with the flu SC2 multiplex, that is a better use of resources, and it really gets at both of the pathogens that we would want them to be looking for in their surveillance efforts.
Thanks. Okay, one more here, and I'm not sure if you know this, will know the answer to this question. This is asking, will CMS sunset the HCPCS code for the CDC assay as well?
I have no idea. I don't know if anyone from CMS is here today.
Yeah, I don't think CMS is not on the call, but we can forward questions about any type of reimbursement to CMS and see if we can get an answer from them directly. So the next one, can we still order the multiplex from the manufacturer?
Yeah, and actually see the one right after it, and can we order the singleplex from IDT? And so the multiplex, the manufacturers are not distributing those directly under the CDC's EUA. And so I guess I should be clear again, for both of these assays, for both the original assay that CDC is going to retire and the assay that we will continue to support, the multiplex assay that detects flu and SARS-CoV-2 together, we have made all of those primers and probes publicly available, and the formulations for those tests available for others to seek their own emergency use authorization, you know, for. So anyone using those primers probes in their own assays, that will not be affected by this decision. My understanding is that IDT has not been selling the multiplex assay under CDC's emergency use authorization. We have been distributing that. We have been the only purchaser of that, and we've been distributing the multiplex only to our public health partners. The singleplex assay, the original assay, was being distributed through IDT and through BioSearch under our EUA. That is what will stop. But they should be available, to my understanding, you know, through the end of September, or as long as they have inventory through that time period.
Okay, thank you. I think there's just one more question here that you may be able to answer, and that is, will IRR be offering both enzymes authorized for the multiplex assay or just the P/P and primers and probes and controls?
I believe that the IRR will continue to, I think the IRR will still have the authority to offer the enzymes. However, I think that the focus of that has changed. I will say that there was a requirement early on in response, again, just due to the incredible demand and not being able to keep up with the demand, that there was a need for IRR to distribute that. I believe the intention is for IRR to, again, to public health laboratories, distribute the primer and probe sets, and that our public health partners would be using the funding that they got independently to purchase the enzymes for the kit. I think that is the answer. I can go back and double check on that as well.
Okay, thank you so much, Brandy. Those are the only questions that I see popping up that I think are for you. There are some other questions, and we'll do our best to direct these to people who might be able to help us answer them. So thanks for being with us again today. And if you want to monitor and see if other questions come in, feel free to answer them during the rest of the call if you have time.
Thanks, I will.
Okay, and so at this time, we will move to our next speaker, who is Dr. Daniel Rhodes from the Cleveland Clinic, and he is going to be talking about genomic changes causing SARS-CoV-2 detection partial failures. So take it away, Dr. Rhodes, and I will advance your slides for you.
Thanks. Thanks so much for the opportunity. Thanks for joining. Thanks for all the attendees joining. Next slide, please. This is just a map of the SARS-CoV-2 genome, just to point out that, you know, different regions of the genome are targeted by assay, you know, many different assays. This was published more than a year ago. But there's, you know, lots of different parts of the genome that are interrogated by diagnostic assays. Next slide. So by the CDC's definition of a variant of concern, one of the ways to get on the list of a VOC is to have diagnostic detection failures associated with the variant. So I just highlighted in yellow the text that's used by the CDC. For example, widespread interference with diagnostic test targets. So if the variant results in unable to detect the virus with our routine methods, then that'll get on the list of a VOC. Next slide. Trying to be explicit here. So to my knowledge, no complete diagnostic failures have been reported to date for nucleic acid amplification tests, but there have been several partial failures or single target failures that have been reported, and I'm going to describe them in this discussion. Next. So any clinical diagnosticians, any clinical labs on the call, I encourage you to become intimately familiar with your assays if you have not already done so and know exactly what's being tested. So there are some IVDs that have FDA EUA that look for a single target. I think it's important that we recognize as a diagnostic community that a single mutation could potentially result in failure of these assays. Again, I'm not aware of any of this being demonstrated to date, but if you're relying on a single target, then potentially a single mutation could result in failure. Most, I would say, or many IVD assays that have FDA EUA look for multiple targets. So in order for those to result in failure to detect a variant, multiple polymorphisms or mutations would have to occur. Now, even if multiple targets are interrogated, it's not always the same. For example, I'll use the Cepheid Expert assay as an example. If you're using the COVID-only Expert Express assay, It looks for the N2 and the E targets on with separate fluorophores. But if you're doing the 4-in-1 that looks for flu A, B, RSV, and SARS-CoV-2 all in the same assay, it still looks for the N2 and the E targets, but it puts those in a single channel on it with a single label. So if you can't really tell if one of those two targets is dropping out. This is just good to familiarize yourself with so you know what you can expect and not expect if you should encounter a variant with a mutation that results in a target failure. I'll talk about this a little more in the next slides. Next slide, please. Next slide. So I'm going to talk about a couple cases here. So here's case one. There we go. So if you use a QR code, that should take you to the publication if you want to look at it. So they identified that only one of two targets was detected, and that raised their curiosity. So how did they figure out that there was a target failure? What are the steps to get there currently? This is kind of how it currently works in general. So somebody will notice that there is some kind of curious finding in the results. For example, only one of two targets are detected. And this is from the publication. The authors write, since information on the proprietary primers and probes was unavailable, they did more testing. So here it is. So this is what they did. This is what currently kind of you have to do if you want to investigate a target failure, something along these lines. So they saw dropout of one of their targets in the end gene region. So they made two amplicons, amplicon one, amplicon two. They identified three point mutations or polymorphisms, and their assay was not able to detect these amplicons similar to the original viral RNA. So they hypothesized, and rightfully so, that one of these three mutations was responsible for the target failure. So then they created new amplicons to isolate each one of these single nucleotide polymorphisms. And they did this with both what they were, both this mutant or this variant, and also with a wild type or a virus that was positive for this target. And so when they ran them in parallel, kind of the positive control, these amplicons with the positive control and these amplicons with this mutant, they recognized that the positive control was able to detect this amplicon, this N-mid amplicon, whereas when they use the same amplicon, but with this single SNP here, the C to T SNP, now the N2 probe was no longer positive with their assay. So that this is the work they went through to prove that this single nucleotide polymorphism in the genome at 29200 resulted in N2 target failure on the Cepheid Expert assay. Next slide. So this is a different case, different assay, okay? So again, we're looking at how do we currently identify target failures in current state? So this is from, this is WashU data. Here you see over 3,000 tests plotted, 3,000 positive tests, and you can see there's pretty good correlation of the E and the open reading frame 1AB targets. And there's some notable designated with arrows outliers. So these green, blue, and red targets had a strong enough signal or enough RNA in the primary sample that they could go back and sequence these. So when they pooled these three samples and sequenced the E gene region, they were able to identify a common polymorphism that resulted in this decreased detection of the E gene target. So that's kind of a lot of work at current state to be able to successfully recognize and identify a target failure. Next slide. This is the list that I know of currently of mutations or polymorphisms associated with complete or partial target failure. You can see there's multiple parts of the genome, right? The spike gene, the nucleocapsid gene, the envelope gene, and many of you are going to be familiar with the S gene target failure, on the Thermo Fisher TACPATH assay that was used as a surrogate to detect the B117 or the alpha lineage. And these references should be available in the slide deck after the presentation. Next slide. So this is really my last, the last of my slides. And I'm gonna read through it and kind of give my pitch here at the end. So currently, you know, once a polymorphism has been empirically demonstrated to result in a target failure, then sequencing surveillance data can be used to monitor the frequency of that mutation. So once somebody's gone through the work, as was described in case one and case two in the previous slides, then public health and labs performing or assisting in public health surveillance of the genomic variations of SARS-CoV-2 can watch actively for that polymorphism to see if it's increasing potentially or spreading geographically and could result in target failure, whether or not that assay was actually used primarily to detect SARS-CoV-2 in the sample. So using this approach, you can, for example, find a polymorphism that could cause target failure in assay A, even if assay A was never used to detect SARS-CoV-2, just because sequencing identified that polymorphism. So this is my pitch, this is my ask, my request, is that in the future, either through regulation or through the benevolence of manufacturers, that ideally genomic regions targeted by these in vitro diagnostic assays would be made publicly available. So prospective investigation of polymorphisms occurring within the targeted regions could more readily be identified. So then a laboratory like mine or maybe yours, a Sentinel laboratory that's performing sequencing on these positive SARS-CoV-2 samples could find or identify the polymorphisms that are in a region where an assay targets and then challenge that assay to see if it impacts the diagnostic efficacy of that single target. So now it's really, there's a lot of work to go in to figure out, you know, what polymorphism might be present that's impacting an assay. Whereas if the information were to be made publicly available as to exactly which regions each of these emergency use authorization assays target, then we as a community could more easily and prospectively analyze and evaluate these genomes to see if they result in any detection failures. So, you know, the big concern would be, you know, if multiple targets are mutated and they're, which could result in complete diagnostic failure, which we want to avoid, but we also, if it should happen, want to be able to detect quickly. In a current state, I'm concerned that we might not be able to detect it quickly. So that's the next slide is my references. Again, when these are distributed, hopefully they will give you some more information if you want to dig deeper. And then my closing slide is next. And I'm happy to take any questions.
Okay, thank you. Yes, thank you, Dr. Rhodes. We do have several questions, so I will go ahead and ask them. I'm not sure if you can see them. The first one is, what is the frequency of these polymorphisms in SARS-CoV-2 sequence strains that are recovered from patients?
That's a great question, and that changes over time. So, you know, when alpha was present, we you know, a surrogate marker was the S gene target failure on TACPATH that we used, you know, a lot of us used in the UK used to try to track how much B117 was circulating. In the reference that from our group that was cited, you know, for a short period of time, we had a variant or a couple variants circulating that resulted in in target failure on one of the assays, and it was present in about a few percent of our positive samples. But the circulating variance changes quickly, and that variant is kind of gone away from our community currently. So that end gene target failure we don't see currently. So it really changes over time.
Okay. The next one is why not just sequence amplicons with failing probe regions instead of asking manufacturers for information?
Yeah, so it's not clear if something fails, if it's with the probe or with one of the primers. You know, all we know is that it's not positive, or it's not as strongly positive as we would expect. So that would be one reason.
Okay, the next one, can you comment on PCR as a monitor for variants?
Yeah, there are, you know, some assays, LDTs, RUO assays that look at common SNPs in the spike protein gene. And that's one way to kind of get a fingerprint for which variant may be in a certain sample. There's definitely pros and cons associated with using, you know, PCR versus, you know, whole genome sequencing. And it, you know, I would encourage you to start with the goal and work back from there. Sometimes PCR might be adequate. Sometimes you may want to sequence the whole genome.
All right, I think there's one more question here that may be for you. Are you familiar with any target failures associated with the Delta variant?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with any failures specifically with the Delta variant. And I want to reiterate, you know, there's no documented, to my knowledge, assays that have failure to detect SARS-CoV-2. Due to mutations or polymorphisms. What we've seen so far are single targets that would drop out of a multi-target assay. So overall, the assay would still be interpreted as positive for SARS-CoV-2 or SARS-CoV-2 detected. It's just a single target that we've seen drop out. And this has happened with multiple manufacturers. I mentioned, you know, the Roche-Cobas assay, the Cepheid Gene Expert assay, and the TACPath, Thermo Fisher TACPath assay. Those are the ones that have been published, but they're also the ones that are most easily probably defined because they're the most commonly used. So less frequently used assays, I would say, we're probably at risk for not finding failures as easily because they're not as widely used.
Thank you. I think I missed part of what I said. I was on mute. So just thanks again. Thanks for being here, for giving the presentation. And if there are other comments you want to respond to or questions that you want to answer in the Q&A, feel free to do that. But we will move on to our last speaker. Wrapping things up again today, like on many of our calls, is Dr. Tim Stenzel from the FDA. And Tim, are you with us? Tim, are you on the line?
I'm double muted, sorry. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you now.
Fantastic, okay. Great. Yeah, and it's Tim, by the way. So I was asked to update this group on a shortage situation having to do with sodium citrate blue top tubes. And I'll do that, but there were a couple other topics that were mentioned already in this call that I thought it would be useful to give a FDA perspective. So I will go through those two. But first, the first topic was blue top citrate tubes. So those tubes are primarily, if not exclusively, used for coagulation studies and tests. And with COVID, obviously there is a hypercoagulable state, and lots of COVID patients have required coag testing in relatively overall in the world high volume. So it has strained the supply worldwide of coagulation specific tubes, Vacutainer and other type tubes. So we were able to use the EUA provisions because this is COVID related in order to allow the BD blue top tubes that are only currently labeled for anywhere they can send CE mark tubes, which are not the same tubes, or at least not the same authorized tubes that are used in the United States. So the FDA was able to take a look at those tubes and look at the differences. The differences were in our review immaterial. I can go through those. But the good news is that those tubes can now be imported into the U.S., even though they were not originally authorized for use in the U.S. under the EUA authorization that we made last week. So we hope that this helps relieve the shortage in the U.S. And the volume that BD has promised coming into the U.S. Is substantial through this mechanism. The other two providers of sodium citrate tubes do not have a separate non-U.S. authorization. So they don't we didn't have the ability to use that mechanism to increase supply of blue top citrate tubes, and that would be Grinner and Sarstedt. The Sarstedt tubes use a little bit, fairly substantially different collection method. So only those institutions that are currently using Sarstedt tubes and or want to move to Sarstedt tubes and be trained on how those collections are done. They just have a proprietary collection mechanism. But anyways, all three providers have signaled to the FDA that they will be interested in working to increase the supply in the U.S. And so we are in continued dialogue with them on that. So we hope that these efforts will result in fewer shortages in the U.S. and a decrease, at least by the end of the year, of the complete back order situation. So we are continuing to track that. So hopefully that explains that. I wanted to go back to the CDC decision to withdraw their original test from distribution and just clarify some things, because the FDA has received some questions about this as well. So, certainly there are a number of tests that use the writer reference from the CDC test in order to get their tests authorized. The CDC's withdrawal of their test from the market does not impact the authorization of those tests at all. In fact, once we make a decision on a test, including a right of reference, that that decision and that right of reference is in that file and cannot be reversed for that reason. The other thing that we heard is that there was a question about whether the whole EUA authorization pathway was going to be removed or changed for all other tests, and that is not true. The emergency is still declared. The FDA is still accepting EUA submissions and will continue receive them, we believe, for a very long time, and we will continue to review them according to our current priorities. And we continue to get somewhere over 100 to slightly under 200 on average submissions a month still at this point in the pandemic. So we are staying very, very busy still. And then to comment on Daniel's talk, which was excellent, and the particular issue that he was mentioning, to my knowledge, did not affect the overall result because it was a multiplex test. Also, the polymorphism in question, I believe, was a single base change, and it was a little bit unexpected that the signal would drop out from that. There was a comment from Daniel, which I think would be, is an interesting comment, I'll say, about making primer and probe sequences available. Of course, the FDA received those primer and probe sequences in our review. We review those. As part of our review of all molecular tests. We also receive now the antigen used in serology tests and the antigen used to develop antibodies for rapid antigen tests. So we have the sequences, either amino acid, but ultimately the base sequences, for all the types of tests that the FDA authorizes. We maintain the database. We weekly update that database with all new sequences deposited in USAID since the last time it was updated a week ago. We then interrogate all assays with known, obviously all those factors that we look at, primer probe sequences, antigens, et cetera, for any potential issues. We then do our own analysis, and we have a level of triage as to whether those could impact tests or not. Those that are thought to potentially or maybe definitely impact results, we then reach out to the developers themselves and ask them to do their own analysis, and if needed, to do wet testing to confirm a problem or performance. We've done that scores of times now already in this pandemic. We maintain a website at the FDA, and it's a variant and mutation website for SARS-CoV-2 diagnostics. You can go there, and we keep that as up to date as possible. We also have a weekly town hall call where if we find out something that's important, we do announce that on the town hall call, and that might happen prior before our website being updated. There are a handful of tests that are listed there, and the one that Daniel mentioned is there, and explains everything in detail. Usually when something is done like that, and companies do additional work, if there is any impact, we will update the authorization and include that in an updated instructions for use so laboratories know what's going on. And so in that way, we try our best to maintain knowledge about test performance. The other thing I should mention is that we are working closely with the CDC, NIH, and the RADx program. And we have a network of labs within that system that for the U.S. government is able to test various devices whenever there's an issue that the FDA highlights as a potential problem, and they assist us in evaluating this as well. We collate all the information from that effort as well as from the developers in making our decisions about what notices to make on our website. The interesting suggestion was for developers to make all their primer and probe sequences basically available at least to their users, and there is nothing that the FDA does to prevent that from happening. And I would say, though, that developers do view those sequences as proprietary trade secret information. I'm not stating the FDA opinion, I'm just stating the industry opinion, as I understand it, that that they've worked hard to optimize those primer and probe sequences. And if they make them publicly available, someone can come along and obviously copy their design. And with a more limited patent protections that are no longer available to developers, trade secrets are something that companies are going to use. So again, the FDA does not prohibit developers from releasing their primer and probe sequences. However, when developers submit primer and probe sequences to the FDA, same thing goes with the antigen tests and serology tests, the FDA by law is required to keep those sequences confidential and secret. And there are severe penalties, financial and jail time penalties, if anybody at the FDA revealed any of these secrets outside the FDA. So there are severe consequences for that. So the FDA has limited, obviously, ability to make those sequences known. I think that covers the topics that I wanted to cover, and I haven't been following the Q&A, so there may be some questions in the Q&A that, Nancy, you may want me to address.
Yes, I think there's just one here, and this is back on the topic of the sodium citrate tubes. The question is, does FDA approval to import sodium citrate tubes from CE supplies at Becton Dickinson extend to the shortage of the Becton Dickinson cell preparation tubes that also use sodium citrate as an anticoagulant?
If I see full question. So cell preparation tubes, CPT tubes, I think is what the question is. Is it covered under that EUA authorization? And the question would be no. This is specific for a specific CE marked sodium citrate tube from Becton Dickinson that is a blue top tube. As we become aware of anything that is COVID-related that is in shortage that we can use the EUA authorizations for, we will examine that. So please let us know if that is the situation, and we'll work with the vendors to understand the nature of the shortage. We do maintain the shortages team. The EUA authorization, though, was specific for blue top sodium citrate tubes.
Okay. Well, thank you, Tim. I do not see any other questions for you today, so you have it relatively easy. So with that, I will let you go back to your whatever you were doing before you joined us. And this is going to wrap things up for us today. We are ending a little bit early, which I know people don't tend to mind. So we thank everybody for joining us on the call. We encourage you all to opt into the CDC Laboratory Outreach Communication System, or LOCS, to receive ongoing lab communication related to the COVID-19 response. And to join this list, if you haven't already done so, you can send us a message at locs@cdc.gov. As I mentioned before we got started, we will be posting the slides from this call, the transcript, and the audio to our website by early next week. Go scroll here past the FDA information and to our CDC social media information. But to access any of the resources that we've talked about, you can visit our preparedness portal. So we hope you will join us again for our next call, which will be Monday, August 9th, again, 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. We encourage you to invite other clinical laboratories, partners, and colleagues to join us for these calls. If you have questions to submit after the call that you would like addressed on a future call or that you need a response to, you can still send them in until this call ends through the Zoom, or you can email them to dlsinquiries@cdc.gov. And again, we always appreciate getting your email address so that we can respond back to you when you put these questions in, either on the calls or through our mailbox. And so with that, we're going to wrap things up. Thank you again for your time, for joining us. Thank you again for all of the hard work that you continue to do in helping out with the COVID-19 response. And we will be back again with you again 2 weeks from today, same time. Thank you very much.